Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. This morning we'll enjoy another installment of Anna King's Daughters of Hanford series. We'll also hear about health care issues in Washington State. According to a study from Washington State University, neighborhoods where non-English speaking Latinos live tend to have the most toxic air quality. But first, we look at business in the Northwest. Taxes, health care, and climate change are framing issues in upcoming elections on both sides of the river. We begin in Olympia with Austin Jenkins. Washington voters are showing once again that they like the idea of a two-thirds requirement for tax hikes. In early returns yesterday, Initiative 1366 was passing with 54% of the vote.
This was the latest offering from professional initiative sponsor Tim Iman. It would cut the state sales tax by a penny next spring unless Washington lawmakers send voters a constitutional amendment. That amendment would require a two-thirds vote of the legislature or a vote of the people to raise taxes. At a gathering in Seattle, Iman declared victory.
I think it's time, once and for all, for us to settle this debate with a two-thirds for taxes constitutional amendment vote. That's what the voters have voted for 5 times, and tonight they voted for the 6th time for the same thing.
Opponents immediately said they would challenge the constitutionality of 1366 in the courts. Washington lawmakers are currently in contempt of court and being sanctioned for not coming up with a plan to fully fund schools. House Finance Chair Reuven Carlisle, a Democrat, says apparent passage of this initiative adds a level of complexity to the situation. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
Iman's latest tax-limiting measure tell lawmakers to establish in the state constitution a two-thirds requirement for tax hikes or else.
Fremont is one of Seattle's most liberal neighborhoods. Think naked people riding bikes and a statue of Lenin. But the woman who's been called the unofficial mayor of Fremont is a self-avowed conservative.
I do have friends from time to time say, "What do you have a statue of Lenin for?" And I say, "Not my statue."
Susie Burke may not own the statue or the land it sits on, but her family real estate company, the Fremont Dock Company, owns a good chunk of Fremont, about 60 acres. Take a walk with her?
Let's go down this way. We'll go see the dinosaurs.
And Burke offers a running commentary.
Talk about cute, huh? Woo.
About the businesses she rents to.
Very expensive bikes.
And for good measure, throws in the occasional gripe about taxes.
Parking has 7 different taxes on it.
Taxes are a prickly subject with Burke.
I go argue about my taxes if I don't see something right.
Which helps explain why her company contributed $45,000 to Initiative 1366 on the November ballot. This is Tim Iman's latest effort to require a two-thirds vote of the legislature or a vote of the people for tax hikes. Burke not only contributed to get the measure on the ballot, she signed on to the voter's guide statement that urges a yes vote.
This fits me to a T.
And Burke thinks it's a good fit for Washington, too. She notes voters have approved a supermajority threshold for taxes 5 times over the last 20 years.
This is our chance to make it permanent and to let our elected officials know this is the way it works now.
1366 is different than past Iman initiatives. That's because in 2013, the Washington Supreme Court tossed out the last voter-approved supermajority rule as unconstitutional. This new initiative would direct lawmakers to send voters a two-thirds for taxes constitutional amendment by April 15th of next year. If they didn't, the state sales tax would drop from 6.5% to 5.5%. That's an estimated $8 billion penalty over 6 years. Supporters consider that an incentive for the legislature to act. Opponents consider it hostage-taking.
That's what Tim Iman in 1366 does. It holds our kids hostage.
That's Democratic State Representative Chris Reichdahl. He's vice chair of the House Education Committee and a fierce opponent of a supermajority threshold for taxes.
A two-thirds requirement is a partisan, political, self-interest attack to protect the status quo of the tax code to privilege the few.
Washington unions are funding a modest no on 1366 campaign. Angel Morton heads the Tacoma Teachers Union. She notes the state legislature is currently in contempt of court over school funding.
We can't afford to gamble with the future of our kids. We can't afford to gamble with $8 billion. We need to know that money's going to be available for the future of our children.
Morton says what Washington needs is comprehensive tax reform, not tax limits. In Fremont, Susie Burke says she's not the only one who supports 1366.
This is a Mischief Distillery,
where co-owner Patty Bishop is getting ready for barreling day.
And we make whiskey, vodka, and gin.
Bishop says she often disagrees with Tim Iman, but
on this issue, we are totally aligned with what he's going after, because taxation without representation is wrong.
Of course, it's all in how you define representation. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
Correspondent Austin Jenkins continues his look at the debate over Washington state taxes with a look at the Alcoa Company and its decision to idle two aluminum plants just months after state lawmakers renewed tax breaks for the company. Language that would have required Alcoa to pay back those tax savings if it had laid off workers was not included in the final deal.
Alcoa operates plants near Bellingham and Wenatchee and employs about 1,000 workers. In June, Washington lawmakers extended for another decade a package of tax incentives for the aluminum industry that were set to expire. Republican State Senator Linda Evans-Parlett advocated for the renewal on behalf of Alcoa, whose Wenatchee plant is in her district.
The reason we're doing it for 10 years is to provide some certainty. There's some work that needs to be done on the plant, investments for infrastructure, and they need to know that they have this tax incentive so they will reinvest in that plant.
A proposal in the Washington House that Alcoa pay back any tax savings if employment dropped by more than 25% was not adopted. The aluminum industry tax breaks are projected to cost the state nearly $17 million over the next 4 years. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
Supporters of a citizens' initiative to create a new tax on carbon emissions in Washington state have delivered most of the petition signatures they need to put their issues before the legislature and then on the 2016 ballot. From Olympia, correspondent Tom Bonsi has more.
A line of climate change activists, each carrying a box of petitions, marched into Washington's Secretary of State's office with nearly 250,000 signatures between them.
The first revenue-neutral carbon tax in the United States.
The number of delivered signatures would be just enough if each one was valid, but that's never the case. So Chief Sponsor Yoram Bauman says the Initiative 732 campaign intends to gather more to ensure qualification before a New Year's Eve deadline.
This is a grassroots campaign, and so we wanted to provide evidence that we're for real and that we have a terrific path at making the ballot.
Bauman says I-732 was inspired by British Columbia's carbon tax. The measure would levy a new tax on fossil fuels and use the money to lower existing state taxes. Bauman says his campaign is meeting with backers of a separate planned carbon tax initiative to try to forestall having two competing measures on the ballot at the same time. I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia.
The signature total has grown to just under 300,000 signatures, with 250,000 signatures validated. They need the 330 signatures by November 30th. The rival initiative to the people is being drafted by a steering committee of environmental, labor, and community leaders calling themselves the Alliance for Jobs and Clean Energy. Their planned initiative would not be revenue neutral. A fact sheet from the Alliance says it is currently exploring reinvestment options for the monies raised by the fees on carbon, which could include rebates to mitigate energy cost increases for low-income families and spending to help businesses and workers in fossil fuel-reliant industries in the transition away from fossil fuels. The object of the conversation between the two campaigns, according to Alliance Communications Director Brendan McLaughlin, is to coalesce around a single viable climate initiative for the 2016 ballot. He said having two initiatives on the ballot was not good for either. Many Oregonians are facing changes to their health plans right now, yours truly included. The period for signing or renewing has begun through the Washington Exchange as well. While many see their premiums rise only slightly, there may be sticker shock for some enrollees. Steve Jackson has more.
The open enrollment period to get health insurance by January the 1st runs now through December the 23rd, with coverage beginning March the 1st for those who sign up before January 31st. Current enrollees should have received an information packet in the mail detailing the cost of the current coverage, what that plan will cost next year, and the amount of tax credit subsidy you qualify for. The Washington Insurance Commissioner's Office says the average cost of the health plans increased by just 4% since last year. But for one group of enrollees, the increases may be a lot higher. Those are the people with the least expensive plans that may have difficulty remaining enrolled if the cost becomes unaffordable. First, this year's subsidy has decreased. The Health Exchange's Michael Marchand explains it's gone down because it's been based on a specific silver plan that's gone down in price.
The second lowest cost silver plans in almost all our rating areas have dropped. So what we're seeing is that the ceiling is coming down. In other words, gold and silver plan prices are dropping. Bronze plans are going up. And what's happening is, given that the silver plans are going down, means that your tax credit is going to be going down because the price of those plans is dropping.
The end result may be sticker shock for many who are enrolled in the bronze plans because of increased premiums at the same time as the reduced tax credit. For one Spokane Public Radio listener, the rate will be climbing dramatically. She'd been paying $109 a month for a bronze plan, but with the tax credit reduced by $60 a month and her premium also increased another $60, the cost of the same plan next year will be almost $240 per month, an increase of over 100%. About 36% of Washington residents in the health plan are enrolled in bronze plans. I'm Steve Jackson reporting.
You're listening to The Bridge. We continue our look at healthcare issues in the Northwest with a report on new research out of Washington State University. The research indicates that in non-English-speaking Latino neighborhoods, the air quality is more likely to be toxic.
Picture a U.S. map with clusters of flaming red dots laid over it, and the dots represent hotspots for cancer-causing air pollution. That's one way to view Raul Lievanos' research findings. He's an assistant professor of sociology at WSU. On this map, the Northwest looks relatively good. Most of the hotspots are in the Northeast and California. But there are clusters around the Seattle and Portland metro areas. But regardless of geography, Lievanos found similar groups of people in these toxic zones. They're mostly non-white, low income, and there's something else that stood out to him.
It's language and immigrant status as well.
People with limited English ability tend to live near pollution-causing freeways and industrial areas, and Latinos outnumber any other group. Lievanos says the reasons for this vary, but sometimes it's because, historically, city planners put environmental hazards near these low-income areas. He hopes his research will help city officials and others address some needs in these neighborhoods.
Do we have translation services for them? Are there mechanisms that allow for them to be incorporated in the political process or other, you know, important local processes? And if not, maybe that's actually something that influences their vulnerability, right? That should be addressed.
Lievanos' findings are published in the November issue of Social Science Review. I'm Liz Jones reporting.
We conclude our look at healthcare with a report from the Oregon Health and Science University. Dr. Vinay Prasad warns that superlatives like breakthrough or miracle to describe new cancer drugs should be taken with a grain of salt.
Dr. Vinay Prasad with the Knight Cancer Institute looked at media coverage during 5 days this summer. He put the phrase cancer drug into Google, then took turns adding 10 superlatives like game changer and home run. He says superlatives were sometimes used when there was no data on the new drug or when the drug showed only modest benefits.
And we found that, you know, 14% of the drugs we looked at, they had never been given to a human being. It was based only on how well the drug worked in mice or in a laboratory. And we know that that's a very poor predictor of what actually succeeds in the long run.
Prasad said superlatives generate unrealistic expectations and create a distorted picture of the way science works. But it wasn't just journalists who used superlatives. The study found 27% of doctors also used them to describe their work. I'm Christian Fodenvensel reporting.
Thank you. And now on the bridge, we take a look at the careers of two interesting women. We'll meet Franny Smith, a geoscientist. Think fossils, minerals, volcanoes. She studies radioactive particles at the Hanford Nuclear Reserve. Smith wants to see more girls pursuing careers in the sciences. But first, meet Stephanie Beal. She's the recreation coordinator for the Oregon Department of Forestry. It's not always the glamour job you might think. Correspondent Chris Lehman spent some time out in the woods with Beal and has this report.
You don't have to get too far off the Wilson River Highway west of Portland before you encounter the Wilson River. There's no campground here, but it's a popular spot with campers nonetheless. Stephanie Beal says these informal campsites are technically allowed, but you have to follow the rules.
Not clearing ground for your tents, not damaging the natural resource, camping at least a certain amount away from water, burying human waste.
That last one, the one about burying human waste, that rule seems to be ignored here a lot.
We've entered kind of what's the bathroom area.
Beal points to a soggy white mess on the ground.
So just to be clear, what we're looking at here is kind of toilet paper that's been rained on.
Yes, that's a wad of toilet paper. And it's, since I know this site was clean last week when I was here, it's maybe a week old at the most.
It's not just toilet paper littering the ground here. Beal whips out a trash bag and gets to work.
So I'm picking up shotgun shells.
Over the next few minutes, Beal finds some tent pegs, a can opener, a rubber ball, an empty oil can. Over the course of the year, she comes across
tires, scrap metal, and construction debris. It looks like folks replaced their home fence and brought it out. We had a kitchen remodel, so tile and cabinet. Somebody's patio table, mattresses. We pick up all sorts of fishing garbage. We've had a couple of sofas this year.
The Oregon Department of Forestry is trying to figure out how to rein in people who pollute or abuse state forest land. The agency wants to strengthen its ability to remove people who violate its rules. Beal gets a lot of what she calls public contact training and says when she approaches people, they often say they just didn't know the rules.
Folks who feel like the rules don't apply to them or get confrontational, we just break off the contact, back away, and let law enforcement know where they are.
She says sometimes law enforcement does cite people who refuse to comply, but many people get away with it. So forestry staff are working on a rule proposal to the Board of Forestry. One way or another, they're hoping a rule change would actually change people's behavior. I'm in the middle of asking a follow-up question about the agency's new enforcement strategies when Beal quietly suggests I move.
I'm sorry?
Come a foot forward.
Oh. I've been helpfully directed to not stand on a piece of toilet paper. Thank you.
At this point, it probably wouldn't surprise you to learn that the first thing Beal does every time she gets back in her Department of Forestry pickup truck is squirt a generous glob of hand sanitizer onto her palms. She says she tries not to take it personally, this never-ending task of cleaning up after careless visitors.
I get frustrated, but, you know, for every person I clean up after, there's usually a person who sees me cleaning up and offers to help, and that's, you know, what kind of balances it out.
And for the record, if you do need to answer the call of nature while you're surrounded by nature, Beal offers this advice.
We ask that you are at least 100 feet from a stream and that you dig what's called a cat hole. Human waste won't break down if it's just on the surface of the ground. But if you scrape a 6-inch hole for your human waste and toilet paper and then cover it back up, the enzymes that are underground will start to break it down.
Just a little something to bear in mind the next time you're in the woods. In the Tillamook State Forest, I'm Chris Lehman reporting.
Does anyone remember the saying, take only pictures, leave only footprints? In our final feature this morning, Anna King introduces us to Franny Smith, a geoscientist working at Hanford. Women make up only about 25% of geoscientists in the U.S., In the next installment of her Daughters of Hanford series, we'll hear the story of one scientist who would like to see more girls working in science careers.
Franny Smith knew she liked science early in life. It was kindergarten. Her teacher, Mrs. Goldberg, was teaching a song about dinosaurs.
Tyrannosaurus Rex, he was so very cruel. He'd like to come right over now and eat us after school.
That ditty locked Smith fast onto dinosaurs. Later, she discovered volcanoes. But what really cinched science was when her fifth grade class learned about rapidly disappearing rainforests.
And just knowing something in my gut that wasn't right about that. And just feeling like we shouldn't do this. We need to be more careful with our resources.
Now a PhD in geology, Smith studies the long-term storage of nuclear materials. She works at the Pacific Northwest National Lab in Richland. Sometimes when Smith tries to explain what her job is, people get a glazed look. But the nutshell version?
What I do is understand how radioactive materials behave in the environment so that we can safely store nuclear materials to help make nuclear energy sustainable.
At Hanford, she studies how certain radioactive particles like plutonium or technetium are attracted to different surfaces. She says, think of a sock sticking to pants just out of the dryer. That's like uranium particles sticking to a metal tank or the surface of a rock. There are many different types of radioactive contamination here. It's all from plutonium production during World War II and the Cold War.
I hope that we can do our part to return the Hanford site to as much of a natural state as possible while still remembering all the science and engineering that went on there.
The radioactive contaminants at Hanford all move differently underground. Smith's goal? Keep that radioactive stuff out of the Columbia River.
All right, so right outside the fume hood, we have our Geiger counters, and we have gloves so that we can easily get a pair on.
Smith shows me a lab used for training that's sort of like hers. She spends most of her time modeling scenarios on a supercomputer. But Smith believes science cannot live only in computers and labs. She says it's crucial for big brains to get out into communities where decisions are made.
In today's society, we have to make decisions altogether about what we're going to do with this type of material.
She does a lot of talks, meets a lot of teachers. Smith also wants to see more girls get interested in science in Hanford. Smith remembers a couple of years ago when a teacher showed Smith's picture in front of a class. The teacher was explaining rocks and minerals. One little girl raised her hand saying she didn't see a geologist in the picture.
The teacher said, right there, and she pointed to my picture to the students, and the girl said, you mean the geologist was a girl?
Smith says that's the real power of showing students who scientists and engineers are in their own community. That way children, especially girls, can start to see themselves in that role too. I'm Anna King in Richland.
Anna King's series, Daughters of Hanford, includes women with all kinds of experiences with the nuclear site, scientists, secret keepers, and critics. Find out more at daughtersofhanford.org. And that's all the time we have for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part of the program, you can hear it on a podcast at our website at coastradio.org. We enjoy hearing from you. Email questions or comments to News1. That's N-E-W-S and the numeral 1 at KMUN.org. I'm Kate Brister. Thanks for listening. Join us next time on The Bridge.